Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss today's FCC ruling allowing the merger of Comcast and NBC. Craig Aaron of Free Press joins us to explain why he thinks this is a disaster for internet freedom and media diversity. Then we'll be joined by Gordon Chang, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, who is on his way to Washington to testify to the Congress as the Chinese President Hu Jintao visits the White House. We'll look into the two Chinas, the one we are told that has global military ambitions and is scouring the world for resources, and the other, a peaceful power whose industrious people are striving for their rightful place among nations. Then we'll be joined in the studio by Amy Willens, who wrote The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, which recounts the fall of Papa Doc and its aftermath. She has just returned from Haiti, where the deposed dictator just showed up. So stay tuned. Let's begin with the NBC-Comcast merger. I am speaking with Craig Aaron, who is the Managing Director of Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Politics for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. Today, Free Press denounced the FCC's approval of the NBC-Comcast deal, and this is available at freepress.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Thank you, Craig. And am I correct in characterizing your dissent that this is a disaster for internet freedom and media diversity?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. We're calling it a Comcastrophe.
I see.
it is really just bad news for consumers everywhere. Even if you're not a Comcast customer, the result of really pretty much rubber stamping this merger at the FCC is going to ultimately mean higher prices, fewer choices, and way too much media power in the hands of one giant company.
So you would think, though, given most consumers' experience with these duopolies that control cable television and control the last mile and now are basically providing internet service, cable TV, the consumers of this country would be extremely leery because even though we're not aware of how much worse off we are than most developing countries, particularly like Japan and South Korea, nobody's happy with their cable service.
Well, that's right. Everybody hates the cable guy. Everybody's had their problems with customer service, with high prices, with hidden fees. Comcast ranks in consumer surveys consistently right up there with the worst companies in America. And yet when they go to Washington to ask for huge multi-billion-dollar favors, they always get their way. That's partly because they've invested in huge amounts of lobbying, but it's also because our regulators are really falling down on the job and presented with a really unprecedented media merger, one that would give a company like Comcast, already known for a series of bad actions, control not only over those pipes, but also over so much content, and yet the FCC and the Justice Department barely blinked.
And this vote by the FCC was 4-1 in favor of the NBC-Comcast merger, with the Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps in dissent, saying that the Comcast-NBC joint venture opens the door to the cableization of the open internet, which I guess is what we've been saying, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's what we really need to worry about is that when Comcast looks at the free and open internet, they wish it was more like cable TV, where they could pick and choose the channels for you, where they can decide what websites, services, and applications get preferred treatment and which don't. And by adding all of the holdings of NBC, which is not just the broadcast network, but of course more than a dozen cable channels, including MSNBC, CNBC, Bravo, USA, 27 local television stations across the country, really just an immense amount of media power concentrated in a few hands. And it's the type of power that's going to give them an incredible amount of leverage when negotiating with other big cable and phone companies, as well as the other big content companies. So I think Commissioner Copps' concern is absolutely right, and that one of the scariest things about this merger is that it sets the baseline for other mergers that could follow. You know, we've seen over the last 30 years, the media monopoly, as Ben Bagdikian called it, go from 50 companies controlling much of what we watch, see, hear, and read every day, down to five or six, and two of them just merged today. And I worry about how long it'll be before a Verizon or an AT&T or a Time Warner starts taking a look at Disney or starts taking a look at CBS or Viacom. Those are the kind of deals that the Obama administration and the FCC today have, essentially endorsed and opened the door to more of.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who is the managing director of Free Press. And when you say, Craig Aaron, that this is likely to open the door to more marriages of content and distribution, which all of the companies want, they'd have to be in both businesses at the same time. And that takes you back essentially to the movie studios when they had a monopoly on movies, where the studios both produced and exhibited the movies that they owned and had a lock on the market. And that led to an antitrust suit that made the studio split off the theaters from the motion picture production. It seems like we're going back in time here, that antitrust is something that doesn't seem to raise any eyebrows at the Justice Department.
Well, that's right. It's been watered down over the years, and the Justice Department, put a few conditions on this merger. The FCC added a few more, but it seems like we're a far cry from, the days of trust busting, let alone the days of, when AT&T was getting broken up. And yet we've seen so much, they broke AT&T into dozens of pieces. Now it's been put back together into three or four. And here come the cable companies. They want to get in bed with the content companies, and we're seeing that concentration and consolidation happen again and again, even though we can look back at the last 30 years and see that it has been an unmitigated disaster, media consolidation, that is, where we've seen local news operations shuttered or weakened, so many local radio stations, of course, local television stations falling in fewer and fewer hands, not serving local communities like they used to. And it's even been bad for business. I mean, you can look at some of these previous deals, AOL, Time Warner, and on down the list. These haven't even made money for shareholders. So, and yet here we are again, and they're doing it again, and the FCC, with the exception of Commissioner Michael Copps, barely raised a finger in protest. And I think that, making matters worse, we can see where the Obama administration is headed. On the same day they approve this $30 billion mega merger, unprecedented in terms of combining content with the pipes that transmit that content, we've got President Obama. What's he saying? Well, he's on the pages of the Wall Street Journal promising to get rid of onerous regulations, which is, barely even code words to tell big business, we're going to get out of the way and you can do whatever you want. I don't think that's what people signed up for, and it's really shocking to me that that's the message that this administration is taking from their recent political troubles, that they actually haven't done enough for corporations. At least when I go out across the country, I hear a very, very different message from most Americans.
But there was a very different message from candidate Barack Obama, who promised to promote media diversity and prevent excessive media concentration.
Well, that's absolutely right. He said it was a priority as a senator. To his credit, Barack Obama, he voted to overturn FCC rules when they tried to lift regulations, when they tried to do away with limits on media ownership. Senator Obama opposed that. Candidate Obama said these great things about media diversity, these great things about net neutrality and the free and open Internet. But when push comes to shove and when they're actually there to make the decisions, Comcast and AT&T don't have very much to complain about.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the managing director of Free Press, and Free Press's critique of this NBC-Comcast deal is available at freepress.net. So, Craig, am I just to sort of sadly conclude here that the American citizen and American consumer basically doesn't have any power, that that Washington is totally in the grasp of rich and powerful individuals and corporations, and they get their way, and the people are just roadkill?
Well, I'll agree with you on the, maybe not the roadkill part, but I'll agree with you on the second part, which is there's no question Washington is in the grip of these huge and powerful corporations. I don't think that people are without power. I think that they can make a big difference when they act at key moments to improve and change the direction. I think they still have the power of the vote. to get rid of folks when they don't do the job that we'd expect them to do. But it's very clear that a lot of the expectations that people had that things might be changing in Washington, they most certainly are not changing. And so this is a moment, I hope not just for that everyone will leave discouraged, but actually will be redoubling their efforts, getting involved, realizing how important it is that the public is paying attention to these often complex, sometimes hidden decisions, and making a lot of noise to prevent them from going this way. And also, unfortunately, since the FCC seems unwilling to do the job, it's going to be up to the public to watch this new behemoth and really highlight or expose any bad actions by the new giant Comcast NBC.
And Craig Aaron, there are conditions on this deal, some of which remain in place for 7 years. However, my understanding of Comcast as a corporate culture is that they're very hostile towards what is called net neutrality, that there was a hearing, I think, in Cambridge, Massachusetts about it, where they removed a internet site from their network, and in the public protest, they hired a bunch of homeless people to fill up the hall so that nobody from the public could be there to advocate for internet freedom. That is a really unpleasant harbinger to my mind. Am I correct in suggesting?
Well, yeah, that's right. I think we have to be very worried because Comcast has shown time and again that they'll do whatever they can to evade accountability. So they are the company that was caught illegally interfering with web traffic, blocking lawful file sharing. The guy that caught them was trying to share barbershop quartet music in the public domain. The Associated Press tried to share the King James Bible, couldn't do it because Comcast was interfering. They got caught. They lied about it. They evaded. As you note, when the FCC actually investigated and held a hearing, they hired people to fill up the seats and clap on cue when Comcast talked. That was exposed. The FCC finally sanctioned them, actually just forced them to stop doing what they were doing. And what did Comcast turn around and do? Even though they faced no fine, they sued the FCC and actually ended up winning their case and actually putting the FCC's whole authority to regulate the internet in jeopardy. And yet here is the FCC not using any of the leverage, frankly, they had as this merger came along, or barely any of it, as they were debating net neutrality, as they were talking about all these issues, they treated them as completely separately. Now, Comcast, of course, would never do that, and it's very clear from, you can look back at the history of mergers, not just cable mergers, phone company mergers, there's a lot of promises made on the front end until the ink is dry and they're approved, but actually following through, making sure they're respecting those conditions, that's a whole nother matter. And the fact that the FCC seems so unwilling to stand up to these big companies it's supposed to be regulating and seems to see itself as just a deal broker, not a regulator, that's cold comfort to consumers who would hope that the FCC would need to be on the beat to actually enforce these conditions. I wish I could be more positive, but it's hard to see how they're going to do that, you know, let alone if you were to see, you know, for a change of power in the White House and the Republican commissioners didn't want any conditions at all. So the idea that they would be enforcing these conditions 6-7 years into the future, I think, is very problematic. You know, not to mention the fact Comcast certainly wanted to get this deal done, but they do not seem concerned or disturbed by any of the conditions here, and believe me, if they were really worried that this was going to limit them in some way, they'd be making all kinds of noise.
So, Craig Aaron, just in the last couple of minutes then, the cableization of the internet, which is what this deal seems to indicate, and that's what Michael Copps, the dissenting commissioner, said in his dissent. As I say, all of us know how terrible the cable companies are, and that you have these duopolies that control all the markets. And frankly, if you switch from Verizon to Warner's to Comcast, the service is just as bad, and they bundle and they force a lot of garbage on you. This has nothing to do with competition. It's an absolute disgrace in terms of monopolies just squatting on territory. And the rest of the world is moving ahead with all kinds of internet innovation. And ironically, this is where all this stuff's invented. Is it possible, though, that one of the reasons why GE unloaded NBC is that they're seeing further into the future and that this, as much as it is a monopoly deal, it may be about hatching dinosaur eggs?
Well, you know, I think it's possible that'll obviously have to play out, but what really concerns me is that, you know, certainly probably some of the NBC broadcast network, the entertainment, things like that, you know, that might be true, and certainly in GE was not about to go out and be able to buy a phone company or a cable company, so they weren't going to be able to push their things into the internet space with some kind of advantage. But what concerns me is that swept up in that part of the deal is, a lot of 27 local television stations where a lot of people still get their news and information, still the top source of news and information. And in a lot of cities, Comcast is now going to be the only game in town. They're going to control your local TV. They're going to be your cable provider. They're going to be your top internet provider. That's way too much power in the hands of one company. I'm not saying this thing couldn't still collapse under its own weight. And we've seen that happen a lot in these deals in the past. You can look at what's happened in the newspaper industry where, you know, Tribune Company, of course, bought the LA Times, bought the Baltimore Sun. Practically, you're in the process of running them into the ground. But what happens is when that happens, even if it turns out to be a bad deal, the people that end up holding the bag, the people that end up paying at the end, are local citizens and local consumers, because they're the ones who see the newsroom shutter. They're the ones that see when there are problems up at the top levels of the corporations and they're losing all this money, what happens? They cut local journalists and local journalism. They cut independent programming. They cut creative entertainment and replace it with things that don't cost much, like reality TV, like crime shows, any kind of investigative reporting. That ends up being what ends up on the cutting room floor on these bad business decisions. And that's why it's supposed to be the FCC's job not to say, is this good for business? Is this good for NBC? Is this good for Comcast? But is it actually good for the public interest? And that's really where they failed here, because there is nothing in the approval of this merger that explains how the public is going to be better off with the combination of Comcast and NBC.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Craig Aaron.
My pleasure. Anytime.
I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the Managing Director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Politics for the Digital Age. You can find the Free Press response to the FCC's approval today of the NBC-Comcast deal at freepress.net. We'll take a short station break and I'll return in a moment and discuss the Chinese leader Hu Jintao's visit to Washington. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Gordon Chang, who's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He's a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who joins us from the road as he heads to Washington, D.C., where he'll be testifying before Congress. Welcome to the program, Gordon Chang.
Thank you very much.
First of all, this visit with President Obama, which includes a dinner tonight and then a state dinner tomorrow night, there's no way in the world it could go worse than the last visit, right, with George W. Bush, where instead of a state dinner, they had a state lunch. When he was introduced, they played the Taiwanese national anthem. And then a protester from Falun Gong harangued Hu Jintao from the press pool. And then President Bush almost manhandled him. The whole thing, I think, was a disaster. And was it not seen in China, not as clumsy, but as a deliberate insult?
I think that many Chinese took the 2000 visit as a deliberate insult. And you're absolutely right that it couldn't have gone any worse. The other thing is that it couldn't have gone worse than the November 2009 summit, which also was a debacle in many respects. So the summits have not been really very good between the United States and China recently.
And when the Chinese leader says that the real importance of this visit is not so much to talk about revaluing the Chinese currency or the trade imbalance or human rights or Chinese military stance, but it's about harmony. Now, that sounds like a platitude, frankly.
Well, it is a little bit of a platitude. Harmony has special meaning for Hu Jintao. Because what he's been trying to do is to sort of avoid some of the social protests that have been occurring in China, and there very well may be more than 200,000 of them a year. And so the Chinese people have sort of made a joke of this word harmony, using the word harmonized as really a way of talking about repression. So I don't think we're going to hear too much in the way of harmony during this discussion in Washington. But nonetheless, clearly Hu Jintao wants harmony in China.
So that's the verb, I take it, has been used to describe websites that suddenly disappear as having been harmonized away.
Is that? Yes.
So
that is.
That's the Orwellian nature of it, right? So tell me, Gordon Chang, I understand that within the ruling circles, Hu Jintao is referred to as the African. Is that correct?
Yes, there has been those words. I mean, in any leadership, you're going to have some derogatory comments about the senior leaders. But I think Hu Jintao basically does have the respect of his colleagues among the Politburo Standing Committee members and among the Central Committee. He is the first among equals. He has some problems in the sense that the generals and the admirals seem to be taking some of his power away. And, of course, as he gets closer to 2012, when the fifth generation leaders are supposed to take over, he is losing some power as sort of like the lame duck.
But, I mean, are we imposing our American political lens on China? A Chinese lame duck may not be the same as our lame duck, because I understand that Chinese politics are about consensus building and personal relationships. And the longer you're in power, the more you build these relationships. Therefore, it's not inconceivable that at the end of his tenure, he has more power than he had at the beginning.
Well, certainly in 2012, he will have more power than he did in 2002 when he took over. And you're absolutely right that there is no clear demarcation from one day you're president and the second day you're a private citizen. It doesn't work that way in the Chinese system. But nonetheless, leaders do lose power. And as people are starting to think about the political transition, I think they start to sort of avert their gaze from Hu and start thinking about Xi Jinping, who is supposed to be the next leader. So there is going to be this inevitable transition, and it's not going to help Hu Jintao that he's an outgoing leader.
Again, I'm speaking with Gordon Chang, the author of The Coming Collapse of China. We're talking about Hu Jintao's visit to Washington, D.C., and although he is often considered dull, he's a hydraulic engineer by training. I mentioned earlier the nickname The African is because he seems to have an affection for Africa and has traveled there quite a bit. And there's a lot of concern expressed often in the press about China's growing economic power and its search for resources as some kind of new form of resource colonialization, if you will. A lot of that is overstated, isn't it? I mean, you know, in Australia, they refer to Australia as China's quarry. And in Africa, there have been some protests about the Chinese management of mines, etc.
Well, China clearly does not believe in the spot market. It believes in direct ownership of assets. Essentially, though, Africa is not a new story because Mao Zedong, the first leader of the People's Republic, really did have an Africa focus himself. And that's because he saw that the Africans would be his allies in really the struggle with the Soviet Union for primacy among the Communist Bloc members. And so essentially China has had this Africa focus for a very long time. But now the focus is, as you point out, more on natural resources, on oils, on minerals, and that has got countries worried. I think that this is one area where we need to be probably less concerned than others. But there is one exception, and that is rare earths, where China basically cornered the market, now has about 98% of the production. They did that through predatory trade practices, and now they're trying to use their monopoly on rare earths to obtain geopolitical goals, and they do that in violation of their trade obligations. So with that exception, I think that, you know, I do agree with you that this is just normal competition.
As you mentioned earlier, Gordon Chang, that Hu may be overlooked or outflanked by some of his admirals and generals, he is nevertheless the chairman of the Central Military Commission. But there's been reports, I think mostly from our side, that the visit of Gates, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, that was upstaged by the flight test of this new jet stealth fighter, the J-20, it appeared that Hu Jintao was not informed of this in advance. If that's true, does that mean that the military in China has gone rogue?
Forgetting for the moment whether Hu Jintao knew about the flight test of the J-20 last week, it is clear that the generals and admirals are getting more power. There is remilitarization of Chinese politics and policy. This has been going on since the early part of, let's say, 2002, 2003. And it is very concerning because many of these flag officers and senior colonels do have pretty belligerent attitudes toward the rest of the world. Matter of fact, last February, we heard these comments in public about waging war on the United States. I think that's really the big story that we see generals and admirals talking about matters that once were exclusively the province of civilian officials. So, yes, we need to be concerned about whether Hu Jintao knew or didn't know about the test of the J-20, but there is this bigger story that, indeed, these guys in the military are gaining much more influence.
But under Deng Xiaoping, did they not allow the military, because they were concerned about the military budget being onerous, to diversify and get into business? So isn't there this peculiar kind of schizophrenia in the military that they're both in business and in the business of the military at the same time? And I understand that the Yang family is a dominant force. Is that right?
Deng Xiaoping had basically a policy of four modernizations, and modernization of the military was one of the four, but it was the least important of them. And they did get into business, but Deng's successor, Jiang Zemin, started to get the military out of business. And although he hasn't been completely successful, I think that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, is much more modern and is indeed giving up some of its business links. Now, unfortunately, it still has some important relations with defense, what would be defense contractors in our system, in their system, state enterprises, in defense industries. And so the line is not so clear, especially with these big conglomerates. But as I said, this is not a story too much of China's military, whether they are in business or not. It's a question of how much influence they have on politics and policy.
But I understand, though, from reports following this flight of the Chinese stealth fighter, that on the internet, where you get a flavor of what's happening in China, particularly amongst the young, that they're not particularly happy with this kind of spending. And also, China's signals, I think, in a very fundamental way, with its strategic nuclear arsenal. It still has something like 25 strategic missiles, presumably pointed at the United States, and we and the Russians have thousands of them. So put that in perspective, if you will.
We don't know the number of warheads China has, but it's certainly more than 25. It's probably going to be in the 400 to 500 range, and that's enough to do a lot of damage to the United States.
Are they on strategic one or tactical, though? That's what I understand. There weren't that many on strategic missiles. There's a lot of tactical weapons, but not strategic ones.
Their strategic weapons are in the hundreds, and of course they do have tactical weapons as well. They are in the process of what's called MIRVing their rockets, which is put multiple warheads on them, and they are developing semi-capable submarines, which means that they can get very close to U.S. shores. So this is something that is important. It is something that we look at, of course. But yes, the United States has more warheads than China does. But you got to remember that with the START Treaty that was recently ratified, the United States is reducing its weapons, its strategic warheads, down to about 1,550. And that makes China's arsenal a factor. And China is not a part of the START arrangement, which means that China is going to become much more powerful in the sense of the warhead race when we start to look at the numbers.
Well, since you've written, Gordon Chang, the book The Coming Collapse of China, and recently the New York Times had a lead story about how we tend to exaggerate China's power and influence around the world, whereas the Chinese leaders are always looking over their shoulder and riding the tiger of internal dissent and changes within the country. Let me try and get a sense, just in closing then, about these two Chinas that appear to emerge, and that is the one that we're told has global military ambitions and is scouring the world for resources, and the other, a peaceful power whose industrious people are striving for their rightful place among nations. So is it one, the other, or both?
Well, China is a communist party, which can be a little bit nationalistic, and certainly, as we've seen, has a military which is extremely belligerent. And the Chinese people, on the other hand, who, as you were describing, you know, peaceful, they want to just have more say in their lives, they want to go about their business, and that's a very dynamic China. But it also makes it a very unstable China, where you have a people and their government essentially going in opposite directions. The Chinese people moving forward, the government becoming more repressive, more nationalistic, more belligerent. This is not a good combination for social stability or, for that matter, peace in Asia and the world. And that's the real concern.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Gordon Chang.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, I was speaking with Gordon Chang, who's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He's a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst, and joins us from the road as he heads to Washington, D.C., where he will be testifying before the Congress. Let's now take a short break, and we'll return in a moment and talk with Amy Willens, who has just come back from Haiti. She'll be joining me here in the studio. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with award-winning writer Amy Willens, the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and last year's Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She is a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. She has just returned from one of her frequent trips to Haiti. Thank you for joining us today, Amy
Thanks.
Willens.
Thank you.
Your book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, you chronicled the downfall of Baby Doc and its aftermath. You go to Haiti and then you come back and then suddenly he shows up there.
I have to say we never really meet because I was there for 5 days and then he left the country 25 years ago. And I'm there for 2 weeks. I leave and he comes back the next day. So I don't think we're fated to be intimates.
So the fact that there were a few hundred supporters outside his hotel, in the overall scheme of things, what does that tell us? I can't imagine that he's particularly liked in that country.
He's not particularly liked in that country at all. He's particularly disliked in that country. And my guess is, from what I heard from other reporters on the ground there and when watching the tweets come through as the news was breaking, is that most of the people who were there were old friends and family and friends of family who supported him and his father during the Duvalier dynasty. So that the crowd, my guess is, because it was in the hundreds and not in the thousands, was really kind of just a show of solidarity of a friendship group and a political group around him. And, you know, then maybe there was some money given out for excess people too.
Well, he's supposed to have stolen hundreds of millions, but then I understand that his hideous wife fleeced him in the French courts in their divorce.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And he's down to, what, a few million, and the Swiss are holding on to $4.5 million in frozen
assets.
Right,
they've frozen some of his assets. But let's put it this way. He did manage to take two flights. That's more than most Haitian people can do. And he did manage to come into the country with a caravan of cars following him and go up and stay at the fanciest hotel now available in Haiti after the earthquake. So he's got something.
So is it possible that some of those 200 are the people – because he was a sort of dauphin when he came in. His father
put his hand on his shoulder and said, "He will follow me." Yeah,
for life.
For life, president, yes. For life.
And but he was 19 years old.
Oh, yeah.
And presumably there were a coterie of advisors around him for some time.
Well, yes, quite strongly there were a coterie of his father's advisors around him. But he himself, you know, has to be held responsible for the way his administration played out. I mean, he was 19 when he started. He was almost – I think he was 35 when he left power. So it was a long time. His father had been long dead, and he has to take responsibility for the abuses of his administration. He can't simply pass them off on his father's advisors. He wasn't a baby.
Well, that was the sort of semantic cover, wasn't it? Baby Doc.
Yeah,
Papa Doc. We know from Graham Greene and other sources what a monster he was, but it's hard to believe that the Tonton Macoute didn't from one day to the next suddenly get kinder and gentler under the baby. They were still the same Tonton Macoute. These
sunglass wearing, pistol packing, civilian secret police, basically.
Right, who made a living through terror and extortion.
Extortion, protection money of the smallest to the largest business people, so that you'd have a little market lady who sells charcoal in the market and she would have to pay taxes to the Tonton Macoute.
And so you have the Duvalier stealing at the top And then you have this trickle-down arrangement of extortion and theft through
right.
their enforcers.
Of enforcers who, because of that, were extremely loyal to the Duvaliers.
And what happened to these people when Baby Doc disappeared?
Well, it was very violent. The people rose up against them in particular. I mean, there was an uprising against Baby Doc, but he was symbolized in every corner of the country by the Tonton Macoute. And I watched. I mean, I was there in this aftermath. The people simply went after one by one individual Tonton Macoute. I watched them uproot the Tonton Macoute who ran Pétionville up above Port-au-Prince. I went out to Cabaret and I watched them uproot the Tonton Macoute there. Sometimes they would simply kill the guy, and that was really awful. Sometimes they'd load him into the back of a truck, and I don't know what would happen to them.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by author and journalist Amy Willits, who's just returned from Haiti. That sounds a little bit like, the liberation of Paris from the Nazis and the retribution against the collaborationists.
Right.
Was that the feeling?
That was the feeling, but there was also and there always is in Haiti, there's a French revolutionary feeling all the time in Haiti of, getting back at the enforcers of the nobility, in a sense.
But Préval, who's not particularly popular – and he seems to be AWOL since the earthquake.
That's a big problem for him.
And he's an old colleague or friend or associate of Papa Doc, Baby Doc, isn't he?
I thought No. He's Aristide's Dauphin.
Oh, he's Aristide's Dauphin. I see.
So he comes out of the Aristide movement. He comes out of the popular movement.
Right.
He's utterly unrelated to Baby Doc, except perhaps right now, because nobody understands why Baby Doc has returned to Haiti.
And that really is puzzling, isn't it? Because first of all, he wouldn't have returned just suddenly on a whim.
No,
some groundwork had to be laid, surely.
His old nickname was Baskethead because his head is so large, and so that was his nickname in Haiti, Tête Panier, and it basically means empty head. Also, but I say that he couldn't be so much of a baskethead as to return to Haiti without having made some kind of provision for his safety and continued freedom.
Well, one of the people who has spoken out in outrage, and his story I think is particularly powerful and really quite shocking, and that's Bobby Duval, the former soccer star.
Right.
He was starved and tortured for 17 months.
Yeah, Bobby is this guy who can never keep his mouth shut, and that was a real problem under the Duvaliers, under Baby Doc as well as Papa Doc, and he spoke out against the abuses of the government, and he was a fairly prominent figure from a very fancy family, and he was taken and he was thrown into this infamous prison in the sort of marshes by the water called Fort Dimanche, and he was left there for 19 months, and I think he weighed something like 90 pounds when he emerged from the prison, and the only reason he emerged alive from that prison was the work of Jimmy Carter and his administration, an administration that really did care about human rights, and they worked to get Bobby out of prison.
Right, and Carter since did play a role, did he not? That I remember.
He did. He was among the outside monitors who validated Aristide's election,
along with Colin Powell and. Who was the third person? I can't remember.
I can't remember, but it was a bunch of illustrious figures. Yes.
Yes. And but it always comes back. It's deja vu over again, doesn't it?
Well, for me, it's like a horrible, hideous nightmare, a return of the repressed or something to have him back there again. Right. It's as if everything I've worked for and militated for 25 years has suddenly been erased by his return.
And
it's unthinkable.
Well,
but anything is thinkable.
And why is that?
Well, I think that the political moment is very fragile right now. There was an election in November. Préval really tried to push one candidate of his party into the runoffs, at least, so that he would be one of the two final competitors and would be able to compete for the presidency. And the international community does not seem to agree that Préval's candidate was one of the two finalists. The OAS issued a preliminary report saying that, and Préval has not yet accepted that OAS report, putting him in a really difficult situation. And it was an election tainted with a lot of fraud on everybody's part. So there's this political vacuum, and then Duvalier appears like a figure from the past – It's kind of a weird moment in Haiti.
And a very popular singer was disqualified from that election.
Well,
another singer, I think, might well have won. I mean,
Wyclef Jean was not allowed to run.
Right. But then the other fellow.
And now this guy, Michel Martelly, Sweet Mickey is his nickname. Right. He is, the OAS has said, along with Madame Mirlande Maniga, a woman, educator and former First Lady of Haiti, that Sweet Mickey is the other person leading in this election. But it all remains in a state of Prévalian paralysis because he's refused to say yes to the OAS report. And who knows? I just think they're not really counting votes. They're interpreting the political situation, both sides.
So what explains, as somebody that's visited this country over the years, written about it, clearly somewhere there's some affection / obsession, something that attracts you to this country. At the same time, there's this feeling of compassion fatigue about, you know, how much can we continue to care?
Well, I have no compassion fatigue. Now, Americans may have compassion fatigue.
Right.
I don't suffer from compassion fatigue because if you go to Haiti, you don't suffer from compassion fatigue. You have a lot of compassion for these people. And this earthquake was a devastating event in a country that was already at the end of its tether in terms of poverty and in terms of penetration by globalization. This is one of the biggest problems in Haiti is that the economy is not really in the hands of Haiti, and there's not really a local economy, and there's nothing really left for the Haitian people to work with in terms of the economy. And I think that's a gigantic problem, and it's one of the reasons that there is among older people a slight nostalgia about the Duvalier administrations because they think that the better economy was because the Duvaliers were in power, whereas the better economy was, I believe, because globalization had not penetrated as far back then, 25 years ago, as it has today.
Again, I speak with Amy Willis, author and journalist who's just returned from Haiti. We're talking about the mysterious and extraordinary return to Haiti of the former dictator, Papadoc Duvalier, and in general, I'm trying to figure out not so much why I have compassion fatigue, but why, for example, recently 60 Minutes did a piece on a year after the earthquake on all the money that went in. And I remember talking to a scholar on Pakistan who was very disturbed that Pakistan had not received anything like the international aid that Haiti did, and it translates in Pakistan to $2.30 per person as opposed to $500 per person in Haiti. And $500 is not a lot here, but I believe it's quite a bit down there.
Well, it's twice what you would make in a year.
So what happened to that $500 per person?
It hasn't gotten to the Haitian public. It was promised. A lot of it was promised and not delivered by the international community. I mean, there was a lot of money given by average Americans and people from abroad that went to smaller non-governmental organizations and did filter into Haiti. Whether it got to actual Haitian people, I can't say, because these non-governmental organizations, some of them are very good and some of them aren't so good. So sometimes money is taken off the top or goes to cars or buildings and things that don't get to the Haitian people. But in terms of the international community, the larger givers like the U.S. and the IMF and the World Bank, that money has not even gotten into Haiti to begun to be used for various reasons. But so I don't think the Pakistanis should be so jealous. Lots has been promised, but very little has been given. I hope the Pakistanis have gotten more out of what they were promised.
Well, the 60 Minutes piece featured an aid NGO aid worker down at the airport who had all of this stuff in warehouses. I mean, tons and tons of stuff that could address the cholera problem, which was breaking out at that time. And he said that the only reason he couldn't get this stuff out of the warehouse was because he didn't have a particular stamp on this documentation. And that sort of smelled of some kind of bribery and extortion. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how all these suffering people could suffer more because of a stamp, a requirement of a stamp on a piece of paper. And you've got Bill Clinton and all these people weighing in down there. And apparently Clinton has some influence and also has a similar kind of affection that I take it you have for the country. And yet, how do you explain that? Is that the vestiges of what you call the morally repugnant elite? Do they have their fingers in everything?
It's partly that there's corruption. You're right. It's partly that the Haitians wish to have a process. You know, they want to know what's coming into their country. Mm-hmm. They want to document it. Would you advocate that the U.S. would just open up customs and say, whatever you want to bring in, bring in. We know you're people of good heart. Of course, that's cholera medication. Thanks. Mm-hmm. You know, don't fill out any forms. Just bring your container in. No, you would not accept that in America. And the Haitians don't want it. So there are two things working. There's the customary terrible corruption of la douane or customs in Haiti. And then there is this feeling we should know what's coming into the country. You got to get the right documents. And I didn't see the 60 Minutes documentary because I think I was in Haiti. But there are a lot of people who have gotten their cholera medication in. So I don't know. Did they pay protection money? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the Albert Schweitzer Hospital has to pay protection money to get its cholera medications in. They're running a very successful cholera clinic. So I don't know who those people were, but all I can say is get the stamp. Mm-hmm. Go get the stamp. Figure out how to get it. And I don't think that people should have to pay protection money to get their mm-hmm. stuff through customs, obviously.
But the morally repugnant elite that I referred to, which mm-hmm. was, I don't know. Was
the 11 families.
That was it your term? Or
I think it's a general term in Latin America.
I thought one of those families controlled the ports, that was a part of their monopoly.
Yeah, there's a family. I'm not sure they're part of the morally repugnant elite, but there is one
they
family.
They seek to join it.
Yeah, there's another strata of people who control a lot of flow and money in Haiti, which are the import-export people, and they're not always the morally repugnant elite, fancy families.
So what – and the other thing that I saw recently was during the hurricanes that happened, the flooding and the pictures of all of the refuse in the streets sort of going down to a sea and the lagoons full of detritus. It was just shocking beyond belief, and that was led into the pieces about cholera because that was a perfect kind of right. petri dish for cholera. And the obviously what arises there is there any way to reverse the environmental damage? Because a lot of it's because of the deforestation, I think, that the flooding is particularly devastating.
Well, one problem is if you have no economy and yet your economy is basically focused on urban areas, then you're running a cash economy. And to get cash, the Haitian people have been cutting down their trees. Now they're
For charcoal.
Yeah, to make charcoal, which charcoal is a big business in Haiti. Not only is cooking done on charcoal, which is huge – but I know this sounds ridiculous. Dry cleaning and bakeries also run on charcoal, and they use up huge amounts of charcoal. The Haitians like the dry cleaner just the way we do. So that's where the charcoal gets used. And so their trees are going into a cash economy. And they wouldn't cut down their trees. They know what the trees do. They hold the ground in. They give you fruit. They want their trees. But it's a very practical decision.
And what could change that? I mean, because I know it feels like from the privilege of the United States, we're trying to impose, you know, Beverly Hills values on
the
third world.
Green revolution.
I hope you don't see me that way. But,
no.
But I'm trying to figure out how you can break this cycle.
Well, you know, I think I said to President Preval in a much earlier conversation that we had, I said, you should just say, I'm arresting anyone who cuts down a tree. And if you try to sell a charcoal bag, you can't do it. No more charcoal markets. And he said, I can't do that. They have to live. People have to live. I can't just say, suddenly, I'm arresting you. But he did say that if Haiti could somehow get its economy back and begin to cultivate rice and really have an economy that worked, an agricultural economy that worked within the country, then – you know, people wouldn't have such a need.
But wouldn't it require just a replacement for an energy source?
I mean, there are. Can I tell you about probably 200 NGOs trying to replace this energy source in Haiti? And I think they will. I mean, I think they will. But I don't think it goes to the basic problem. that fueled the charcoal problem in the first place. But yeah, there are solar power, lots of ideas for solar power, lots of ideas for natural gas. And there are things in the works. I don't know if they'll really be taken up by the Haitian people.
Well, I mean, for example, Hugo Chavez is single-handedly keeping Cuba going by supplying Castro with oil. I mean, do we have a Hugo Chavez on our side?
Yeah, he's helping the Haitians a lot, too.
He's helping the Haitians, too.
A huge amount, yeah.
Yeah. But in other
words, he's a bankroller for the Prevost government.
You would think that, you know, just as a form of – if you're going to be giving aid, you might as well target the aid to something that can actually break the cycle of destruction.
And be sustainable. That's
true. But that everything's ad hoc, is it?
There's a little bit of an ad hoc patchwork feeling in Haiti among the people who are trying to fix things.
I see.
And that's one thing that the Haitian government would like to fix if it were only capable of fixing it.
So what's – just in closing then, Amy Willis, I guess we don't know what's happening here, but there is this sort of dark feeling about the emergence of this hideous person from the past that feels such an insult to the process of
democracy.
It's sort of, you know, rubbing salt in the wound, insult from insult to injury, you know.
It is sad to have an earthquake that kills from 200 to 300,000 people, and then a cholera epidemic and a hurricane and a flood, and then Duvalier comes back. I mean, you have to say that's not a good sequence of events. But maybe we're just packing together all the worst possible things so that the future can be brighter. I hope that there will be some resolution of the political situation in the next few weeks.
And at this point, he says he will either stay for he's only going to stay for 3 or 4 days. That was always his plan. But he says he would like to stay there permanently.
I think he would like to stay there permanently. And today he was like charged with some crimes and has said that he will be available to justice, whatever that means.
Right. But he just had a conversation with a judge.
Of course, it's Napoleonic code down there. It's not like our law, so it's a little different. It's more like New Orleans law.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us in the studio.
Thanks so much
for dropping by again. I've been speaking with the award-winning writer Amy Willis, the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and last year's Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She's a long-time contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. She has just returned from one of her frequent trips to Haiti. This has been Background Briefing. You may hear our archives and contact me at ianmasters.com and on Facebook at Ian Masters Media. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and engineer Ray Palias, and I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 for another Background Briefing. Until then, bye for now.